It is time for the Media Beat. David, of course, comes on, joins us every Friday with the Media Beat. He has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent. He reports on ethics and belief, and he's got a whole history of incredible reporting on a lot of different incredible things. And I'm sure that this will be tucked away in the future as one of those incredible moments in time. Good morning, David.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
And good to be with you. The stuff hit the fan Thursday of last week, we haven't even come close to peeking at my first. I guess question to you, David, is I wasn't around. I've been in broadcasting for 50 years now. Okay, I guess I was old enough to be aware of what happened in the Second World War. I was born in 1952, but I wasn't around for that. But I would almost seem like this country now, and a lot of parts of the world are going onto a war footing.
Sure, and I think it's being deliberately cultivated in some quarters, at least, as being a very necessary thing for the public mind, as it were, to be focused and concentrated. Getting on a war footing is a metaphor that we use in many areas. It's been used not so effectively, in fact, very ineffectively rather negatively in terms of its overall use in the area of drug addiction. The war on drugs turned out to be a very inappropriate way of approaching that problem. War on poverty, well, that's highly debatable too. But I understand the basic thinking about it, that, you know, normal life is suspended because, yes, extreme situation from what was it when we can put a starting point on it? I guess just the arbitrary selection of time. You know, when we were at a point back on March the 3rd when there were just 122 cases of COVID-19 in this country, and within 2 weeks on March 17th were nearly 8,000. We haven't seen anything yet. All the modeling done suggests that everything is going to get very much worse, and the measures that are taken are necessarily going to get cranked up too. There's debate, and good healthy debate, about the usefulness of some of the preventive measures being put in place, and also debate about how long they should be they should remain in place. But it's all pretty clear that we are just at the beginning of a very, very difficult period in our national life, and then the global life of this planet too. The word uncharted water keeps coming up, and it'll keep coming up during our conversation too, because I don't think I've ever been, any more than you, I don't think I've been in anything quite as severe and broad and all-encompassing as this crisis. And it calls upon us all to you know, practice our trades in the best and most appropriate way possible. I'm wondering if I can turn the tables on you a little bit, Marshall, and ask you a question, perhaps for a change, in your area. And this is, I'm asking it because your particular area of the media itself, local public broadcasting, has, I believe, a really special responsibility at a time like this. What's the mood in your broadcast area, and how are you responding to the public need?
Well, the way we're responding, and it started last Thursday, and it continues every day. Last Thursday, when the news broke at 11 o'clock, it was about 9 hours worth of me entering and putting on air and putting online local information from New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, what was happening. It continued with an additional 5 hours, 5 to 6 hours on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And all day, every day this week, there's at least 3 hours worth of prep work in the morning, and then normal updates right through about 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. for different updates, news updates from New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. And then we even started a special section for businesses that underwrite with us to give them free underwriting announcements explaining how they are changing their business to meet the ramifications of what their state governments are doing. And for us, because we serve three different states, that is three different sets of rules that we have to check. And then go through that. And so we've got a separate listing on that. Our homepage has a listing of all the announcements that come from all the states. We have interviewed bank presidents, bank directors, business directors so they get on and leave the concern of people of the flow of money. We've talked about different ways where the SBA is offering extension loans in the different states and how to apply for...
So that's the Small Business Administration, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and then how to apply for unemployment. We've posted links on that in each state. And what we've tried to do is we're playing more music on the morning show just to try to get people's minds, and it's older music from the 70s and early 80s and stuff, just for a few minutes lapse where people don't have to think. I mean, the closest case we know on record of coronavirus to us was reported yesterday in New Preston, Connecticut. We do know that Berkshire County and right above us, their level of contamination where people are getting sick and actually identified as coronavirus has gone up. Of course, in New York State, unlike the city, it's gone up, but not anything like in New York City. So, I mean, we have been kept very, very busy both on air and online.
I can imagine. Yeah, in fact, it's an old adage of journalism, and it applies to live broadcasting. Live broadcasting journalism more than any other is that one should never ask a question that you don't in fact know the answer to. And when I asked you to talk about your side of the microphone, as it were, how things are going for you, you've given me in fact exactly the answer I expected. Good public radio broadcasting on a local level is one of the things I believe that's going to get us through this crisis. And I don't want to sound self-congratulatory or over laudatory of you good selves at Robin Hood Radio, but that's you're doing exactly what is needed. And I imagine, just confirm this in an answer for me, would you, what you see your role as being as public broadcasters in your district, what's your responsibility?
Well, you know, that's interesting, David, because when I first got into radio, I got into radio as a disc jockey. Hey, I wanted to play music. I wanted to have fun. I wanted to meet girls. I wanted to go out and party. That slowly evolved into still loving to play music and still liking to go out to do things. But over the past, since we've started this radio station, it really has been a message to, our main message is to inform. Local radio was in the habit of going by the wayside with all these big companies taking over. And, you know, at one time this area had not only WKZE AM and FM, it had WQQQ FM. Those stations, WQQQ FM is now broadcast out of a college on the coast. WKZE has moved to Red Hook, New York. And so we have in our immediate area covering northwestern Connecticut, we have all of our radio stations, and covering adjacent eastern New York, our radio stations, and covering South County, Massachusetts. Thank goodness we still have a local radio station up there, WSBS. But it's become even more. We run an announcement saying there is no more need for anything other than a local radio station in a local community that is, and all our transmitter sites are backed up by alternative power. So we stay on the air when there's a crisis. We spend a lot of money doing that. But there is no quicker way to get the word out than through radio. And of course, radio now involves podcasts on demand and social media, not only on the air. So our, you know, that is a, the first words to myself on Thursday at 11 o'clock when all hell broke loose was, okay, time to put on your big boy pants, because this is the reason you got into broadcasting. Really, when it comes right down to it, it's communication and keeping the public informed. This is where radio really can step up and do the job. It's not easy, and I'm not patting myself on the back because we have other people that work here at the radio station. But if you are at a true local radio station and not one of these radio stations that simulcast other signals from other major cities, this is what...
Of which there are many, of course, yeah.
This is what
you don't do that.
No, this is what we got into the business for. This is what we do. And when, whether it's a snowstorm, whether it's a hurricane, whether it's a tornado, or now something more prolonged like this, it's what we're trained to do. And it's what we need to do and want to do.
Yeah, and nationally, I think that applies as well, without the detailed infill that you are doing for essential services on a local basis, that absolutely is vital information that people need to get. And as you say, radio is the quickest way of doing it, and all the pertinences that come with that now, podcasting and the social media dimension of broadcasting that is so essential now too, that all plays into it. And on a national level, I think it's probably fair to say that a balance needs to be struck. And what gets covered, there's a terrible tendency, especially on national and highly rated media. I'm thinking of cable news in particular, where the desperation for more eyeballs dictates what gets covered. And there's a terrible tendency to sensationalize, to veer towards panic, the very thing that we don't want. The last thing that journalists need to be doing, although it's a tendency in our profession to do it anyway, because we know that in some ways it works for us, it gets us the greater number of eyeballs that we want and in a sense need. There's no point in being in mass media if you don't get a mass of an audience. But the tendency is to yell the sky is falling. And what's so interesting for me as a media commentator to see is that on the whole, And I would stress this is more true of public broadcasting than commercial broadcasting, but it is true of most commercial broadcasting too, which is showing itself to capable of doing its best right now. And it is a time that calls upon us to be at our best. But we can vary between, and I'm glad to see this, that the media are carrying the stories of human nature at its best, as well as at its worst. At its worst, we see stories about people profiteering. The infamous case of the brothers who bought up whatever it was, 18,000 Purell dispensers, and then tried to sell them online at the hugely inflated, gouging prices, until they were outed, and Amazon took a firm line with them, and so did the public at large, of course. And indeed, you know, at the high public level of good heavens, a very prominent senator, a senator who's very prominent, in fact, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, privy, obviously, to a lot of detailed governmental information, but using that information to do two things: warn his own constituents and supporters in a private meeting that the situation was a lot more serious than the government as a whole was admitting at the time, certainly more than the Trump administration was admitting. And not only that, but also sold off all his shares in particularly hospitality sector companies before the inevitable slump in prices was going to happen. You have that kind of story on the one hand, and at the same time, journalists being dedicated as they should be to all the stories that show how we are how we are responding in humane ways to this crisis. The school bus drivers who turn their pickup routes, which can't happen if your schools are closed, of course, and turning those routes into distribution routes for getting school meals out to kids who wouldn't have a meal in the situation of all their schools being closed. So that kind of balance of what we pick as our output subject matter is all very important too. And I'm on the whole, I'm glad to see that the media are responding well. There are obviously pockets of extreme and bias and nefarious purposes at work in the media. There's fake news to be wary about, of course. But I think that the balanced coverage that we're getting is something that I think, for now at least, we can pride ourselves on doing a pretty good job.
It's interesting, and when you look at the international news coverage, and you look at what's happening in Italy and now in Germany, but Italy especially, and this is one of the questions I wanted to ask you. When I heard the death totals coming out of Italy, and how the death totals in Italy far exceed what happened in China, all that comes to my mind is that the Chinese are not being open and honest with us at how devastating it was in their country. They might have a handle on it now because we didn't know about it really forthright how bad it was until they've been dealing with it for about two and a half weeks. So, you know, we're 2.5 weeks behind the curve there. But I just cannot imagine that a country the size of Italy is going to have more deaths than a country the size of China. And this is the information.
It is absolutely striking that Italy should now surpass the vast country that China is in numbers of its deaths. But that's what happens when a pandemic takes hold. The proportions are not always directly reflective of what you would think mathematically is the greater likelihood. China has one of the things that's held its numbers down is a very strict draconian, a word I know you've been using in your area about measures. Draconian doesn't even describe it in China's measures that they've taken. So they've managed to hold their numbers down, and now it seems that they're really worried more about not so much in community spread, but spread into China of people with the disease, bringing the disease in from overseas, kind of ironically. But you're right also that China got off to a very poor start. Our gauge for this, and it's a gauge that I trust, and I think it's right that we should trust it. The World Health Organization requires countries to report honestly the state of their nation's health, especially when something highly contagious is involved, as it's clearer than this. And indeed, China's first reaction. It's a totalitarian state. We shouldn't be surprised that this was their first reaction, was to repress knowledge of this problem. No dictatorship likes things going wrong on its watch and doesn't like people knowing about things going wrong on its watch. And that's what happened in the original area of incidents. What is interesting that compared with previous outbreaks of communicable diseases in China, that the World Health Organization was extremely critical of China's performance during. What has happened in this case is that China saw the light pretty quickly, not quickly enough. You're quite right that they were behind the curve, and that's responsible for it getting established at all. But they did recalibrate how they categorized illness, and they certainly altered completely their approach to information about the disease and the disease's spread. And the World Health Organization is now rather you know, they're pleased in the sense that, I mean, they've got a terrible job on their hands worldwide, but they are confident in the numbers coming out of China now, even though that wasn't the case at the beginning. It's a tricky territory, this, because of course it's a dangerous road to go down to play the blame game, and especially to play the blame game in a xenophobic way, as our president is doing now, talking insistently about this being a Chinese virus. Well, yeah, first known cases started there, and consequently we call it, we're open to calling it names to do with nationality, like the Spanish flu, if you recall that. These are shorthands that are in themselves insufficient and in some sense really inaccurate. I mean, a virus is a virus. It doesn't have a nationality. But the way that description can be used in a divisive and certainly when it comes to a multicultural country like this, it's a dangerous thing to do, to weaponize the vocabulary in the way that our great leader is doing at the moment.
Well, also,
I think it's entirely wrong also to blame the Chinese for creating a worldwide epidemic, although clearly they could have taken better measures than they did at the beginning.
You know, what's interesting about China's handling of it, the United States did know better. I mean, the congressperson you're talking about and another congressperson that actually sold shares knew about the dangers of this virus about a week and a half to 2 weeks before Donald Trump even had his first press conference calling it basically a Democratic hoax. So not only did China get out of the starting blocks late, but the United States did as well, and we're still playing.
Yeah, and it's worth saying also, Marshall, that we have a narrative now which is so clear that it began in China. Well, things might look different when we look at it with some hindsight further down the road. Already, it's becoming clear in Italy that there were cases being reported of some strange disease of the upper respiratory system in northern parts of Italy back in December, particularly with old people. It wasn't being treated as an epidemic because it wasn't recognized as what we now believe it is. So it may well be that there are other parts of the world that have been experiencing this particular coronavirus even before China was recording the high numbers that became very clear very early for them.
You know, it's what's interesting when you say that, because Jill and I were talking about this, that we believe, just like those cases in northern Italy, that this virus has been lying here in this country since late December, because we have so much interaction with China. And also, when Jill and I were talking about this, she pointed out that the Chinese knew about this when they sent their trade delegation in to the big meeting that happened. And when you look at this, this obviously has been in the United States longer than that. I would figure that most of these countries will find that if they dig back in their records, they're going to find cases. If they have people that travel back and forth to China, that this infection dates back into coming into the countries probably sometime in the middle to late end area of December before Christmas time. That's the whole thing about pandemics. Once they're underway and once they're over, you can actually trace back to maybe not exactly where it came from, but you can trace back the time that actually entered into the country that you're in. It's the science behind this is absolutely astounding.
Yeah, and the other thing is that we just can't get away from. So whatever the origins may be, we are now confronted right at this minute, as we speak, with doing the best we can in terms of tamping down and that ever-recurring phrase now, flattening the curve. because all the models that the great scientific advances we have made in covering this kind of contagion is showing through all the range of modeling. It's not just the worst case scenarios, but the less bad case scenarios, suggesting that we have a huge job ahead of us to flatten that curve, the curve that will give us very considerably more cases in this country over the next two months, say 8 weeks for clear. For sure, we're going to get a peak developing, and all the measures that are being put in place are really essential to prevent that rampant growth in the incidence from overtaking our capacities entirely. Because even the less bad case scenarios are suggesting that in both America and in my own home country, the United Kingdom, the incidence of cases are going to be something like 8 times more than what are, even with the best plans of the moment to increase provision, they will still be 8 times more than our whole hospitals and intensive care units capacity could manage, even with improvements that are planned in the meantime. Also, even given the ramping up in provision that the authorities are attempting to make now. So even the less pessimistic models are ones that should really concern us and really concentrate our minds in the business of keeping the transmission of this disease as it goes to its absolute minimum if we can.
And what's worse about this, about the United States, is you see the pictures from spring break in Florida with all the millennials crowding the beaches, and most of the people on the beaches now in Florida are not from Florida. They are from other places where college kids come in for the spring break.
Well, it is spring break, yeah. After all, yes.
And that doesn't help. That doesn't help at all. The governor of Florida should have shut down those beaches immediately. And once again, that didn't happen. And that's the whole thing about this country. Sometimes we just don't think and look at the big picture. We just don't.
Yeah, and the big picture now includes not only the behavioral problems of masses of people who don't want to change their pattern, and despite the fact that we may need to be on a war footing, but the endemic problems that we face as a country compared with many others are huge uninsured population, the lack of sick pay as a normal fact of life. It's a freakish condition compared with other countries where sick days are a matter of course, and a high number of sick days too, for which you get paid. And the fact that, even for all the people who do have insurance, out-of-pocket expenses, co-payments and the like are so high, it all combines to make the infrastructure of our health service nowhere near as responsive and effective in keeping the nation healthy, putting us at a distinct disadvantage to other sometimes smaller countries who at least have systems that can respond more flexibly. South Korea hasn't done a bad job, for instance, and it's a it's one of the demerits that needs to be highlighted in our journalistic coverage too, as well as our coverage of all the things that we are doing well. And I'm at pains, and I was just recently at pains to say that some things that we are as a nation coming out pretty strong and humanely. And doing the good things that can keep this crisis to its least impactful nature.
The media.